And welcome into the Chase and Big Joe show here on 102.5, 106.3 The Game, brought to you by Regal Realty Group. Looking to buy or sell? Contact Regal Realty Group. Let them do all the work for you. And next thing you know, you're living in a beautiful house, or your house is sold. They do such a great job. Regal Realty Group, contact them today. All right, Mike Organ's in studio with us for the entire hour. Mike, good to have you. Before we go any further, not farther, farther is a measurable distance, further is to push the subject along. Congratulations, you got a big award because you did the Greater Nashville All-Decade High School Football and Basketball Teams back to the 60s. And the AP awarded you with to be in that category.
We're in the top 10 right now and up for number one.
What a huge – and I know you had people help you out. Name, who helped you out?
M. Portner. She did the layout presentation, did a fantastic job with that.
How long – I mean, that's a daunting task.
Oh, gosh. You wouldn't believe it. It's I spent all day yesterday. First, you have to name it. And of course, I'm friends with all these people now. The closer we get,
right.
You know, the 60s, it was tough because I know all those guys and girls. And then the 70s, and then the closer you get to it, these are, you know, companions. These are, you know, people that I grew up with. And I'm into the 80s now. Finished naming the 80s. I finished naming the 80s girls last night. Then you have to go back and write a capsule on each one.
Ooh.
And I say capsule, it's really just, it's a short story on each one.
Right.
And it's a lot of research.
I bet.
So I named the 80s team and then the coach. And I don't want to say who the coach is, but I'll be having lunch with him tomorrow before his game in Murfreesboro.
Okay. Well done. Oh, when you do something like this, all right, so like a Darius Garland goes to Brentwood Academy was fantastic. John Jenkins at Station Camp. Is it fair to compare them with a player in the 60s and 70s, or is it fair to compare the player like Charles? Where would Charles Davis rate versus Darius Garland, who went to McGavick, played for the Chicago Bulls? Is it fair to do that?
It's tough because the game has changed so much, and you know, we see that now with the women's game being compared to the men's game, and the Maravich comparisons,
right.
And with Caitlin, and it's even tougher when you look at the 60s, where it was all set shots, and especially in women's basketball, because it was a completely different game. I mean, it was in Tennessee, it was 6-on-6 until 1980. That's not that far back, you know. And I remember when the game changed. And so it was a completely different game. For listeners who don't know, it was 3-on-3 offense, 3-on-3 defense. So there were defensive players that didn't get to shoot the ball. They didn't get to go across half court.
Wow.
And that was changed in 80 and 79 when Pat Summitt said, I won't recruit another player that plays 6-on. I won't recruit another player from the state of Tennessee because the state of Tennessee is still playing 6-on-6. And they changed that rule the next year. So, yeah, it's very difficult. I mean, you can't compare a girl that played in the 70s to a girl that plays now.
Yeah.
I mean, there were some great defensive players back then, but then what kind of defense? I mean, they were only playing defense. What are they doing now? But, yeah, it's tough. I mean, Charles Davis with the three-pointer would have been incredible.
Yep.
I remember stepping into Vanderbilt Gym one day, Memorial Gym, and Charles was in there before practice, and I watched him make 7 in a row from deep in the left corner that would have been three-pointers. He didn't have that luxury in high school.
That's right. By the way, Pat Summitt. What a beautiful, wonderful, amazing woman who just put basketball. I mean, to say, I'm not going to do this because it doesn't benefit the game. I'm done with that. And for them to say, yeah, you know what, you're right. And to change that, that's remarkable.
I was covering a Final Four a few years in the 90s at some point, and I was talking to Vivian Stringer, a great coach in her own respect, Rutgers, and I think she was at Iowa at the time. And we were talking about Pat. And she said what Pat did with the 6-on-6 was incredible. She said I was in Nebraska or Iowa. She was in a state at the time that she said after Pat did that, I stepped up and I called a kind of a press conference and I said I will not recruit another player from that plays 6-on-6 basketball from this state. And she goes, you know what happened? I said, what? And she goes, they're still playing 6-on-6.
She got Pat to come in there and take care of that.
Exactly.
And drop the hammer on them. Yeah, just what a wonderful thing to do that. Who is, and I know this is kind of a tough thing, who is you think is the greatest basketball player to come out of Nashville?
Wow, Charles Davis was for so long. We didn't have a whole lot of great players through the 60s and into the 70s. And Charlie D, who really, you know, he was great in the state tournament, but wasn't a completely outstanding player in high school. But he went so far that we always called Charlie the best player from here, because he went on to play at Vanderbilt, and his career there was ruined by Richard Smith, who benched him his senior year along with Mike Rhodes. And Charlie aptly said, coach is smoking angel dust.
Had to be, man.
I know. But he did go on to have such a phenomenal career in
at
the
Tampa.
NBA.
Richard Schmidt did, right?
Richard,
at Tampa?
Yeah, Richard, I think he's still coaching. Richard Smith is still coaching at Tampa.
Wow.
And Charlie D went on to play in the NBA with Michael Jordan.
That's it.
And, yeah, so Charlie D for a long time. But now Darius has got to be in that conversation with what he's done and what he will continue to do for many years. David Vaughn was a great one.
Yep.
We've had so many that have come around. Mercer and Maddox, great team there.
Well, Mercer was fantastic. I remember Bubba Wells at Austin Peay, who got drafted by the Mavericks. You remember his record in the NBA? He fouled out the quickest ever.
Well,
I think
I
he fouled
that.
Was it Jordan or somebody? He did like six fouls in like a minute.
Was and that design? Was
I
that
don't
design?
Remember. I mean, it was like late 90s, or maybe Jordan was with the Wizards then. It was insane. I always remember Bubba Wells from Clarksville. You know, and Sean Marion. People remember Sean Marion.
Sean Marion, great player.
Was from Clarksville.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to go back about Pat Summers real quick, and I know you've done this a lot as well, but there's two moments in my life where somebody's walked into a room and everybody's just like, oh, my God. It's only happened twice. One was Jim Brown. You remember the backfield in motion golf tournament hermit? Jim Brown walked in, and everybody was like, oh, my God. There's Jim Brown, and nobody said it. It was so fascinating and surreal to be there. Next time was when the Lady Vols were practicing at Trevecca, and a lot of people were there to see Lady, because it was an open practice, and Pat Summitt walks in. And Mike, I'll never forget the moment she walked. I was with Greg Ruff. Pat walks in. The entire gym was silent.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Pat comes in, looks around, and says, y'all can talk if you want to. And I was like, oh, my God. She was so wonderful. I mean, those moments are very few and far between.
Yeah, yeah. I remember Pat, though, was so down to earth and easy and approachable and easy to talk to. I remember one Sunday afternoon, I'm on the phone and I hang up, and my wife is like, who was that? And I said, it's Pat Summitt. And she said, are you serious? And she knew very few
that's great
athletes or, you know, coaches. And I said, yeah. I said, that's how cool she is. Walter Payton was in town once, and
nice.
Joe Biddle and I, he was still at the Nashville Banner. He sports out of the Nashville Banner. We got some one-on-one or two-on-one time with Walter. And as a matter of fact, his wife was there. That was a big one for me.
Oh, yeah.
Tony Dorsett, I interviewed at Opryland Hotel. Marcus Dupree was fantastic.
Oh, yes.
Marcus Dupree, Bill King, your friend, was interviewing. He and Bob Bell were interviewing Marcus Dupree.
Wow.
And Bill calls during a commercial and goes, hey, why don't you come over here? You can catch Dupree after we get done. So I drive over there, and I catch him coming out of the building over at 1510 over at Music Square. And his agent's with him, and he goes, hey, we're sorry Bill didn't ask us about this. Marcus just got his money today. He had just settled his whatever it was with Lloyd's of London, however many millions it was.
Wow.
And he said, we called a stereo shop over on Elliston that closes at 5, and we asked him to stay open because Marcus is going to buy something. He said, but you're welcome to go with us. So I climbed in the back. I climbed in the back of this SUV, and we drove from Music Square over to Elliston, which isn't far, obviously.
Yeah.
But Marcus answered my questions on the way. I'm sitting in the back holding my microphone up in the between the seats.
Oh, man.
So then we go in, and, of course, I'm with them. So we go in, and the place is closed. So, but they keep it open, and he's walking around, and I'm walking with him, and he goes, I like this. He had a stereo room at his house, and he said, I'm going to buy a new stereo. He spent $10,000 on a stereo.
Oh, my God.
And this was being the 80s,
mid-80s,
so that's a lot of money for a stereo. It's a lot of money today for a stereo. But he spent $10,000 right then and there on a stereo.
For those who know, that's my favorite 30, Marcus Dupree 30. I mean, it was.
It's the best.
It's amazing. And could you imagine, I don't want to get the break real quick, but could you imagine in the NIL world, what Marcus Dupree
oh
would make right now? Oh. I'm not sure there's another athlete that ever existed that would have made more football NIL money than Marcus Dupree.
And Marcus came on the heels of Herschel, and I was always hesitant. I was like, you know, it's too similar. We can't have – he was from Philadelphia, Mississippi.
That's right.
And I was like – he can't be as good as Herschel. People, you know how people always draw comparisons. Well, this is the next whatever. And when I first heard about it and didn't see him play, I thought, no, these people are just – he was every bit as good as Herschel.
With Barry Switzer, I'm sure he got paid. It's just not –
oh, he got paid. Just imagine if it had been over the table.
My goodness. All right, we'll take a break here. Mike Organ's with us. We will get into – Mike got this great backhanded compliment, wonderful award from this national, very popular sports writer. We'll talk about that next. This is the Chase and Big Joe Show, 102.5, 106.3, The Game.
And his face lost all expression. Said, if you're gonna play the game, boy, you gotta learn to play it right. You got to know when to hold them, know when to fold them, know when to walk away, and know when to run.
Welcome back to the Chase and Big Joe Show here on 102.5, 106.3 The Game. Mike Organ's studio with us till 11 o'clock. We did a thing last week, Mike. We had so many responses and text. We couldn't get to even a third of them. Phone calls about random run-ins with celebrities in Nashville. And one of I used to work at Opryland Hotel as a valet parker. Kenny Rogers was a big jerk. He would come in, park his car. And one time a new valet guy walked over to him and said, hey, you look just like Kenny Rogers. Kenny flips the keys at him and says, that's because I am.
I heard you say that on the show that day. I wanted to call you guys because, or not call, but text in or something. But I've interviewed, you know, hundreds of huge celebrities, but right. One of my favorite happenstance happened right down the street here, the place where you and I met at Club Vita.
Yes!
I'm on my way. I've left the Tennessean office, and I'm on my way to Murfreesboro to cover the boys' state tournament, basketball tournament in Murphy Center. And I stopped to get a workout in, and I go into the locker room, and there standing in his underwear is Rick Pitino. And I think about it, and then I change in the locker room. Then I'm walking out, and then I turned around and thought, you know, I got to give it a try. So I turned around and walked back, and he's still in his underwear, by the way. He's doing his hair.
Good Lord.
And I said, Coach, I said, I work for a newspaper. I said, if my editor finds out you were here and I were here together and I didn't at least attempt to speak to you to do an interview, I said, he'll kill me. And he said, fine, what do you want to ask? And I asked, and I talked to him, and did a little interview, got to the...
In his underwear.
Yeah, in his underwear, and then he eventually got dressed, and while I worked out, he was on the treadmill. Who was the guy that helped him, Dwayne, that got in trouble with UPS?
Casey.
Dwayne Casey was with him,
yeah.
And they came out and did the treadmill while I went upstairs and lifted weights. But I got to Murphy Center and wrote a little 10-inch story on Rick Pitino. Of course, he was headed there, too. He had just gotten off the airplane here at the airport,
yeah.
And had stopped to get a workout in. They let him work out for free, believe it or not. And so he was on his way to Murfreesboro. So
what year was this?
Oh, gosh, 88. Nine, somewhere around there.
Was he at Kentucky then?
He was at Kentucky, okay, yes. Right, yeah. Yeah.
Wow, that's
yeah, great. He's standing in his whitey tighties.
Oh, my goodness. The least surprising thing ever.
Yeah, right? Oh, my Lord. All right, so you have – we'll get to that. I'll get back to that story in a second. But we keep teasing this. All right, so Jeff Perlman, the very polarizing sports writer, a lot of people don't like, a lot of people love him, whatever. You know, he does a great job. Had a thing about the sports writer who suffered the most in covering a team, right? And there, I even tweeted him. I was like, you need to talk to Mike Organ. And Mike, you know, some people also tweeted him about, but he chose you number one, I guess the unluckiest sports, best sports writer in America, because you covered Vanderbilt Athletics and they weren't good when you were there, football wise.
Or basketball. I didn't go to New City. I only had basketball 5 years. I had football 10 years. In 10 years, I covered 27 wins.
From what year to what year was this?
92 to 2003.
Okay.
So about 11 years.
So you got DiNardo.
I had. That's the other thing.
Dauhauer.
DiNardo, Dauhauer, Woody, and Bobby Johnson. So I had 4 years in four coaches in 10 or 11 years.
Right.
I had three ADs technically. I had Houlihan, Todd Turner, and no AD. They decided not to have an AD.
I remember that.
At one point. So I count that as an AD. I had three ADs, and I only had, Jimmy Davey continued to cover the basketball team for 5 years till he retired. And then I had Jan and Kevin. And I had Kevin's first year, and I had Bobby Johnson's first years in football and basketball and football. And Jan's years were not good. No NCAA tournament, no NIT tournament, NIT. Women's basketball, Foster had the women playing well. They were coming around about that time. But football was miserable. I mean, no bowl games. It was a repeat every year. You know, there were 2 5-win seasons in that stretch. Woody had one and DiNardo had one. DiNardo had one the first, wow. And then Woody had won his fourth year.
That's crazy. I remember the 96 Notre Dame game here, football, when Vanderbilt lost 14-7. Todd Yoder scored a touchdown, and it was really close, competitive, and Dow Howard were thinking, well, maybe they've turned the
– yeah.
Maybe they've turned – and they were awful.
They were awful the next year. And then they bring Dow Howard in, and they've run the ball. They've run the I-bone, which DiNardo claimed that he created. And I once saw Boots Donnelly, and I said, what do you think about DiNardo's I-bone offense? And he goes – He said he didn't create that. He goes, Jerry Pierce was running that up at Springfield 25 years ago. He said he didn't call it the eye bone, but he goes, they lined up in an eye formation and ran the wishbone. But anyway, so they didn't have anybody that could throw the ball from me to you. And we're in a small room for those of you who are listening. And they bring in Dow Howard, and he says, I'm going to throw the ball, and I'm going to throw the ball downfield. That's what he says at his press conference to the
– because he had just left Saban, our Belichick staff in Cleveland.
Belichick, absolutely.
Yeah, and Dow Howard, wow.
Yeah, I went up and spent a week with him. When they hired him in December, and the Browns were still in the playoffs. So the Tennesseans sent me to Cleveland to spend a week up there. So I got to spend a week watching them practice. They were preparing to play the Steelers in the playoffs, and I got to spend a week with Belichick, who was just a run-of-the-mill NFL coach.
Yeah.
Nothing to him.
Wow.
And it was no problem to talk to. I would, you know, go to the daily – they let me go in the locker room, anything I wanted to. Testaverde was on that team, and who was the big –
Mark Rippon, yeah.
Mark Rippon was on that team. And, yeah, I went in and interviewed all those guys, and they, of course, tell me how great, you know, what a mastermind Dow Howard was going to be. And he may have been with the right players, but he came here, and at his opening press conference, the one you do in front of the alumni and with everybody in there, he said, we're going to throw the ball and throw the ball downfield. Well, everybody wanted that so badly that everybody cheered. Well, then I get him one-on-one afterwards, and I said, Coach, you don't have anybody that can throw the ball, much less throw the ball downfield. He goes, I don't care. I'll find somebody on this campus that can throw the ball. And then the next year he goes 2-9. It's a complete disaster. They can't throw the ball. They don't have anybody to throw the ball or anybody that can catch the ball. So he lasted 2 years. And back-to-back 2-9s, I think.
And then Woody shows up in 97?
Well, Woody was on his staff.
Right.
He did assemble a pretty good staff. He assembled an NFL staff. And Woody was his defensive coordinator. And – yeah, Woody takes over. Todd Turner tells me, to this day, he tells me it was not the slam dunk that I made it out to be, and that I really got fortunate when I said that he was going to hire him. I had sources that said he was going to hire him. He goes, it wasn't as close as you. He said there were some other people that that I considered, but he did hire Woody.
Oh my goodness.
And Woody did everything, you know, whatever it took, we were going to do, you know.
So were you covering – look, as a football coach, I'd love to be a gambler, take chances. But Woodenhofer had one of the worst calls against Georgia.
Absolutely.
Did you cover that game?
Yeah, and I was in complete agreement with Woody on the call because I had seen enough Vanderbilt. I had the same feeling he had. They were up on Georgia at halftime. Had dominated Georgia in the first quarter, and were still up.
It's a good Georgia football team.
Very good Georgia football team. And they were up, 16-7 or something like that. But it was Georgia had scored and started taking over the game in the second quarter. So at halftime, Vanderbilt gets the ball, and they're back on their own 20, and they go backwards to about the 16, and Woody runs a fake punt with Justin Perkey. Justin had been a quarterback at Good Pasture, so Woody thought he would be good to run the option. He takes a snap, runs to his left where he has a receiver, or he can shuffle pass it, and Justin runs about 4 yards and gets tackled behind the line of scrimmage. And Woody is roundly criticized by everyone in the media. What are you thinking? You're up on Georgia, nationally ranked Georgia, third quarter, and you run a fake punt at your own 16. And I'm the only guy in the room that said, I was with you, Woody. Because Woody goes, I just had this sinking feeling. He said, the game was getting away from us. We were heading downhill, and I felt like we needed to do something, a jolt. And he almost looked forward to this situation because if they'd have gotten a first down, you know, we take the momentum away from Georgia. And I was like, I was right there with you, Woody. I said, I went through halftime. The SID came up to me and was like, hey, what about it? We're up. And I'm like, no, I don't like it. I don't like how it feels. And I had the same feeling Woody had. And sure enough, Georgia goes on to win. Now, the following year, they go to Georgia, I believe, and beat Georgia at Georgia homecoming. And Jimmy Davey went with me to write the column from there, and we almost get killed on the way out because we've positioned ourselves on the sideline to exit the field with what was his name? Cowhead, the coach that didn't last long. You're always good with these things.
At Georgia?
Yeah.
See, Mark Rick would have been there then.
No, it was before Rick.
Ray Goff?
It was after Ray Goff.
Oh gosh. He came from Marshall. What was his name?
Yes, yeah, because they called him Cowhead.
Yeah. I'll look it up, yeah.
Yeah, so we're walking off the field with him and his wife, and we get pelted with whiskey bottles and all kinds of debris as we go through the tunnel, Georgia tunnel.
Love it.
Because Jermaine Johnson, running back for Vanderbilt, about 5'6", 140 pounds, had run right through them that day.
Oh, that's good.
And then after the game, Jermaine tells me he'd lost his contacts in the first quarter and couldn't see anything.
What a great story. All right, we'll take a break here with Mike Organ in the studio at the top of the hour right here on the Chase and Big Joe Show. 102.5, 106.3, the game.
You're a rich girl and you're gone too far because you know it don't matter anyway. You can rely on the old man's money. You can rely on the old man's money.
All right, welcome back to the Chase and Big Joe Show here on 102.5, 106.3, the game. Mike Organ, the Tennessean in studio. How long have you been the Tennessean now?
Hey, can I say this real quick?
Yeah.
During the break, I have to check my phone. You have such a good listener base. I'm getting tons of texts from people saying, I remember when you did that. I remember when you did that.
Yeah.
Hey, talk about this. Talk about that. So
nice.
There's people out there listening.
You sure it's not the Gaines family?
No, the first few were, but they got it rolling. But
Brad's like, stay away from me today, Mike. I'm busy. Oh, God.
How long have I been at the Tennessee? 39 years.
First story you covered, let me think if I get this correct. Moon landing? I'm just kidding. What was your first story?
I was doing the Agate page, which is the scoreboard page. And they had me go out and they let me do a high school story on a kid named Rodney Edmondson was playing at TPS, Tennessee Preparatory School.
Okay.
And he was a running back, and he was working 5 days a week at Western Sizzler. And I went out and talked to him about how tough it was to go to practice and then at 6 o'clock show up and work. He was a cook. Yeah. He wasn't a bus boy. He wasn't on the wait staff. He was a cook, and he cooked steaks from 6 o'clock until they closed. 5 days a week, and of course, got off early on Fridays, but then worked Saturdays. So those were great story, and I still have it because the people up in the layout department upstairs made a metal plate of it for me, so I got
cool.
it somewhere. Yeah.
So did you? So our good friend Jim Wyatt, he came after you to the Tennessean?
Yeah, he came after me. Jim worked with me for actually worked for me. I was the prep editor, high school editor, and Jim was working at the titles for the state full time. Oh yeah, and had graduated from Tennessee. And yes, Jim Wyatt is a Tennessee graduate,
right?
Even though he's the biggest Vanderbilt fan I know.
Yeah,
and he would work full time and get off at 5 o'clock and would show up at the Tennessean because you know he's right down there. He worked down across the street from the courthouse in the state building, and he would come straight to the Tennessean about 5:15 and work till 11 o'clock.
Amazing.
4 or 5 days a week. And, yeah, I had an incredible staff. I had him and Harold Huggins on my prep staff, who Harold had been, you know, writing high schools for 25 years.
Good staff you
and
got
they
right
were,
there.
Yeah, those were part-time staffers right there.
Did you know Jim was going to be something special?
Oh, yeah, Jim was gifted. You mentioned Jeff Perlman. Jeff's gifted. I worked with only a handful of what I would call gifted writers.
Yeah.
I mentioned Paul Scarbina earlier. Paul's a gifted writer.
Right.
Jeff Perlman was gifted. Jeff Perlman was born to write. Larry Woody was gifted. David Clymer was not gifted. David Clymer was a phenomenal writer, a great beat writer, a great columnist, but he was not gifted like Larry Woody.
But he would tell
Woody.
You that.
Yeah. You know if you're gifted or not. I mean, these gifted guys, they roll out of bed and they're able to do it.
I know you're the Tennessean, but I growing up here and folks who have moved here recently, last 10, 15 years, you need to know this, but you won't remember this. I don't think anything's ever resonated with the sports public like the I Beat Biddle stickers. I know he was at the Banner. You were the Tennessean. But, I mean, I played it. I cut it out and mailed it in each week, the I Beat Biddle. I mean, it was – we'll never see that again, but that was – everybody did that. Everybody wanted – and you saw bumper stickers all across town.
Oh, the Nashville Banner did a phenomenal job of marketing Joe. They did a great job. They put him on the side of buses. They got him on the radio with George Plaster and accommodated him where he could be on there every day of the week.
Right.
They did a great job, and that I Beat Biddle was great. And, of course, we worked in the same building. They were across the hall from us, even though we were fierce competitors.
Yeah.
And I remember Joe drove a little Camry, and he cut out the AT and – mashed it together, and he had his bumper sticker said I Be Biddle. And then when the Banner closed '96, we were, like I said, we were fierce rivals. Jimmy Davey, who I've mentioned a couple of times, he once told me, he goes, just remember those guys across the hall are trying to take food off your table.
Oof.
So we were rivals, though we were friends. We would go out to lunch and stuff together. But, yeah, we brought Joe over. We saw what a talent he was, and we brought him over when the Banner closed.
Yeah, God rest his soul. I remember when Joe got inducted to the Tennessee Sports Hall of Fame, he got up there and said, hey, they've only given me 5 minutes to speak. I'm telling you right now, I'm taking every bit of the 30 minutes. I was like, that's awesome. All right, so let's look forward now with things going on. I know you're on the forefront of the IndyCar leaving downtown Nashville, going out to the Nashville Super Speedway. I am not a fan of that because I think it's really cool going through downtown Nashville, but if you can't make it work, it doesn't work. What's been kind of the response to that?
It's been tepid. You know, NASCAR, IndyCar didn't work at this track in Lebanon at the Nashville Super Speedway. They tried it for 10 years from 2000 to 2010, 2011, and it didn't work.
Right.
They got about 4,000 fans, so it just didn't make it up there. Now you're going to go back and you're going to run it 2 or 3 years. Now, of course, this is a completely different time. You have had success downtown, tremendous success downtown, so we'll see. It's not like they're just bringing it back out of the cold, you know, without what happened downtown. On the other hand, Joseph Newgarden, who I've actually not spoken to Joseph since the move has been made. Joseph, his specialty is ovals. He holds the record for consecutive oval wins. He's not done great. I think he had a top 10 finish downtown on the road course. But I'm sure he's happy about this.
Well, I'm sure. On the flip side, NASCAR returning to the Nashville Super Speedway has been a massive success.
Huge success.
Why do you think it's been received so well? Sold out, packed, the staff does a great job. I mean, it's a fun event. Why? I mean, all those – did I answer my own question, I guess?
Yes. The answer is, Joe, that this is NASCAR country. That's all there is to it. I was not traditionally a huge racing fan, NASCAR fan. I assumed the beat when Larry Woody retired. And I always remember Woody always talking about how much bigger NASCAR was than anything else that, football, NFL, anything. Because he covered in the heyday when they were packing stadiums every week. And, I always said, well, yeah, Woody, but you're talking about one race compared to 15 football NFL football games, 16 NFL football games. So, but this is, we are right here in the heart of NASCAR country. We should never have lost the NASCAR race, which our city leaders allowed happen from the fairgrounds. Now that we have a chance to have two NASCAR races within 40 miles of each other, if they're able to bring the fairgrounds race back. The fairgrounds have made a smart move this year. They're going to have a race on Thursday of the week of the NASCAR race in at the Super Speedway.
Wow, because, okay.
And I've already talked to Josh Berry, who is a cup driver. He's already told me. Matter of fact, he brought it up. We were talking. He goes, hey, I want to let you know something. I'm going to run that race at the fairgrounds that week that we're in town for the cup. And I talked to Chase Elliott, and Chase said he's going to try to make it work.
That's great.
I plan to talk to Dale Jr.
Yeah, there you go.
You know, I'm telling Chase and Dale Jr., you know, hey, you guys have said you support it, and, you know, that's how you've done all the talk.
Right.
Let's put your money where your your mouth is, and let's see you show up. I won't be surprised if Kyle Larson, who runs every time he sees a track or hears that there's a track open, if he runs it. So
that's good.
I think there's still a chance that we'll have two races here. But NASCAR's been a huge hit here, along with the awards banquet downtown.
It is. And we got to break in a moment, but I want to ask this first as we go. You and I were at one of the most polarizing, controversial news conferences ever when Kyle Busch won the Xfinity race, whatever it was called back then, the second level tier of NASCAR.
Busch then.
And he smashed the guitar. And he came back and he did a press conference a few weeks or months later.
It was a couple of years later.
Okay. And the PR from the Speedway said, hey, please don't ask Kyle Busch about smashing the guitar. We've moved past it. Please, please don't. He will leave if he's asked. Please don't. So I'm stupid. I'm like, I'm not going to ask that. So I'm holding all these microphones in front. I'm on.
You're down on one knee.
On one knee.
In front of me.
And so Larry Woody says, I'll go first. Hey, Kyle, you smashed that guitar and da da, and then it went straight to hell. That was an amazing media moment I'll never forget.
Mike Curb, one of the nicest guys in the world, a millionaire here in town. Kyle had come back and had donated a ton of money to Belmont's Music Center for computers and other things. And that's what they wanted us to talk about. Tammy Brewington had told us, Kyle's not going to talk about the guitar, and let's just talk about the donation to the Belmont Music Program. And Woody says, I'll start. Kyle, do you have any regrets today? And he knew Kyle. He had known Kyle because he'd known Kurt Busch. He knew all these guys. And he'd known Kyle since he was a kid because he'd known Kurt, who was older. And he knew Kyle could not answer because Kyle is just that way.
Oh, yeah.
And Kyle didn't at first. And then Mike Curb said, hey, let's just ask questions about the donation, the generous donation, and let's keep our questions there. And then Woody says, hey, Mike, how about letting Kyle answer the questions not you? And Mike's like, ho, ho. And then Kyle, that did it. And Kyle says, I'll answer the question.
Yep.
And he just lit into Woody. And that's exactly, he played right into Woody's hand.
And the best part, I'm sitting there on one knee in the middle of all this back and forth. I was like, I just want to die.
Joe looked up at me like, what? He's holding a microphone for the Associated Press.
I got like five
Channel
microphones.
Channel 2. You got about four microphones. Right. He's down on one knee in front of all the others. And he looks up at me like, what is going on? I thought this was just a PR stunt, you know, to talk about Kyle. And he's standing in his jumpsuit. Oh. So after it's over, Kyle's 19-year-old PR guy invites Woody out for a conversation. We were in the press box at the fairgrounds.
Yeah.
And he invites Woody out and gives him a couple of MFs and let's go out here and talk about this. And they go out and Woody gives him the same treatment he'd given that kid. That kid comes back into the press box all red-faced. And then next time Woody sees Kyle Busch, everything's fine because Woody knew Kyle Busch.
I learned so much about journalism that day from Larry Woody of like, we run this, not you. And I'll tell you, David Beauclair, another fantastic writer here, he would ask Vrabel questions from the side, and Vrabel's like, why don't you go sit over there? And Beauclair's like, because I don't want to. And I was like, good for you, David. Good for you.
It was always because David always showed up in the Tennessean in print because we'd take a picture of Vrabel and there would be David on the side with the toothpick in his mouth. He was in every picture we had of Vrabel or any coach.
Fantastic.
All the way back to Fisher.
All right, we'll take our final break here. Mike Organ sitting in for Chase McCabe. This is the Chase and Big Joe Show right here, 102.5, 106.3 The Game. And welcome back here to the Chase and Big Joe Show, 102.5, 106.3 The Game. Mike Organ is for about six more minutes, and then we'll turn it over to the great midday show of Caroline, Willie, and D-Mace. We'll take you to two, and then Jared Stillman after that. A lot of fun there. Adam Schefter reporting that Kevin Byard will be released by the Philadelphia Eagles. That's no surprise there. Byard will find a home somewhere. Somebody will grab him. He's still got some gas left. And then I'm reading this. His college football is expected to add three new things. Helmet communication, which is smart. No more stealing like Michigan did. Tablets on sideline at halftime. And says college football is going to add a 2-minute warning.
I like this because it make you know, college football isn't enough like pro football as it is now anyway. So college football needs to become more like pro football. So let's do some more things to make it like pro football.
Might as well. Caroline Woodley, D. Mace, will have more on that. And Kevin Byard, your release coming your way at 11 o'clock today here on 102.5, 106.3 The Game. All right, so let me quick. We brought this up last week. This whole – every it happens every February. This whole is Nashville going to get Major League Baseball? I say no in the next 15 years. But they rolls around. You're on the front lines of this. What do you say?
I feel like we are. I feel like I do think it's a way off. I think it's 8 to 10 years.
Okay.
I talk to John Lohr a lot. He's head of Music City Stars. I know some people question what kind of pull he has. He has some pull. He's got they're about to release a study in about 5 months about where they are, and I mean all the way down to ownership. You know, that's the bottom line is you're going to have a billionaire step up.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you've got some billionaires that are invested in Nashville.
Right.
Amazon, Jeff Bezos, and then you've got Mark Cuban's got a kid at Vanderbilt now. He's looking for places to put his money now that he sold so much of his interest.
That's right.
You know, there are people out there with money, and Nashville is a town now that people will invest in. So that's the sticking point, that and, of course, a place to play. Now, we still have this metal junkyard downtown.
Steiner Lift, is that it?
Yeah, yeah. You know, we called the guy that owns that, Robert Icahn.
Right.
And we called him at one point when this first started, and we were like, we called him on some island somewhere and said, would you be interested in building a baseball park, a Major League Baseball park at your site? And he said, you're going to have to help me. What site are you talking about? And we said, well, it's Cider Lift in, you know, downtown Nashville, right on the river. Perfect spot. I'm sorry. You're just going to have to give me some more detail. I don't know what you're talking about, what site you're talking about.
Holy cow.
He was on a vacation on an island or somewhere, and it didn't ring a bell with that he owned that piece of property.
Oh, my goodness. I was told, and this is second, third hand, that property is so saturated with stuff throughout the years that it's an environmental hazard.
I grew up here, and that was Steiner and Lift forever. And it's a junkyard. We used to go watch them crush cars there. So forever, it's been a junkyard.
Yeah.
And all that stuff seeps into the ground, so I'm sure it is. I mean, you know, I have no idea what you'd have to do, how much landfill you'd have to put on top of it or what you'd do, but what a perfect area. I mean, it's an eyesore, and it's going to continue to be an eyesore, even with the stadium they broke ground on yesterday. It's going to be an eyesore. And eventually he told us, he goes, yeah, I'd be open to that. But, you know, he didn't even know what he was talking about. So.
I always thought that a good stadium would be, and we had a lot of people call and text in that, out on Percy Priest Lake somewhere. The government owns all that land. Build a nice infrastructure, put a stadium there with the backdrop being the lake itself. Hell, I mean, that'd be fun.
Well, they've looked. They're looking in Rutherford, Williamson, and Davidson. So that'd be still in Davidson, but Lord told me that they are looking in Williamson and they are looking in Rutherford. So you know, in any, you know, that's the way Major League does now. I mean, you have to get out of the town to do something like that, and so there are plenty of options for site and ownership. Those are the two big things, and they've already, you know, Manfred's already said that we're probably looking at expansion in 2030, 2032. Yeah. So it's 7-8 years away.
I think it'd be a while. Also, for Lego. Can you get people in the government to fix Donaldson Pike? Because I tell you what, now that Donaldson Pike runs parallel to the interstate, to the airport and the runway, I drift over the other lane watching planes land. And I was like, what are you doing? They got to fix this.
They're working on the red light at the Donaldson Y first. And that was
worst
that
red light in America.
That was your initiative. So now you're asking for Donaldson Pike. I'll do what I can, but we'll see.
You got all the context. Mike Org, Tennessee, man, I love talking to you, all the knowledge. I love your part-time job working for the Gaines family and everything you do. It's always a pleasure. The text line was lighting up with people with your stories and your knowledge. And the history. Thank you, brother. I appreciate you.
Great to be here, brother.
All right, thank you. This is the Chase and Big Joe Show. I don't know my own name. Just look, there's a better show coming next. Caroline, Willie, and D-Mace will be here. Hey, as we leave you every morning on the show, to our guys out there, if you're struggling, need to talk to somebody on your cell phone, you can dial 988. Somebody's always there to talk to you. If you need to reach out quickly, heck, send me a note. I'll talk to you. I'll just let you guys know that you are wonderfully loved and our world is a better place because you are here. Please know that. And then we love you. Caroline Willing D-Mace, next.